You are listening to the Cycling Podcast, at the Tour de France in association with RAFA, the fastest closing in a world tour, the home of cycling with character. Ride and watch with RAFA in 2019 as a partner EF Education First and Canyon Charan.
Where are we, Lionel?
We're in Gaillac. It's the rest day. We've had a very relaxing morning. I've been for a run. I don't know what you two guys have done, but we've had breakfast in a very unusual sort of hazelnutty cappuccino.
Sickly sweet. Not good, that. Not good, that.
We'll have to get another coffee. We'll get a grand crème at the break.
Okay. Well, as is traditional on the rest day, it's press conference day, of course. We're quite early with our... Only Roman Bardet has beaten us with his press conference today, I think.
That's right,
early,
yeah.
Wasn't he? You were going to go there, Francois, but it was a little bit too early.
Unmanageable. 9:45. So, I mean, I have the impression the press officer of AG2R La Mondiale, yeah, suddenly had the idea that the 9:45 press conference was a bad idea because he sent a picture of the swimming pool at the hotel, maybe probably hoping to attract.
Was no one there?
I don't know. I mean, he sent a picture of a swimming pool before the press conference, like at 9. So he was probably fearing that, you know, some guys might think it's a little bit too early and might be tempted to go for a swim. So there we
just
are.
Just shows you, doesn't it, how, you know, the things change. I mean, there will be some press conferences where there's nobody there and press officers will be trying to sort of drum up support. And there'll be others where they're trying to keep people away. You know, and just depending on the fortunes of the riders at the tour. But as I said, it's our press conference and we've got loads of questions to get through. Should we get on with it?
Let's.
Hi, this is Claire from Leeds. Just wanted to thank you for your coverage and insight into cycling. That's helped me to understand it more and become a real fan in the last few years. So thank you for that. My question is about whether you feel, as the podcast has gained in notoriety and popularity, that you have better access to the riders. You often speak about how TV gets priority, and though you're obviously all esteemed and experienced journalists in your own right, I felt that I'd noticed that you have maybe more access to riders who were younger and familiar to the podcast, such as Theo Gegenhardt, than maybe some of the older riders. Discuss. Hope to see you soon. We're heading to the Pyrenees. Very excited. Thank you.
Thanks for the question, Kath. Hope you enjoy your trip to the Pyrenees. I'm not sure that the media outlet counts as much as how long you've been covering the tour yourself as a journalist, wearing various hats. I mean, Francois, you've been covering the tour for a bit longer than us. Does it matter in terms of access? TV is definitely top of the pile. They get, when it comes to interviewing the favourites or the defending champion or the man in yellow jersey, they always get first dibs on that, and we have to take whatever we can get. But in terms of interviewing other riders, is it the media outlet that determines access or your own sort of standing and status relationships?
Yeah, I think that's both. I mean, that there's an unwritten rule. In mixed zones, in most sports events, standing sports event, not like the tourists moving around and you interview guys on the bike, you can, you know, ride away easily. And, you know, in other sports, I mean, the rule is written. TV, the rights owners have priority, then the TVs without rights are second, and then the radios and blah, blah, blah. And the written press comes at the very end of the line. And so being a podcast, we're a bit in between. They don't exactly know where to put us, but I found something strange. So yeah, sure, a guy with a camera will always have priority in the eyes of the rider. You know, the rider is, there's kind of an attraction to the camera, so they will go there first. And something I noticed, because I collect quotes in two fashions, with a microphone, with a Zoom we use for the podcast, and sometimes for the official website of the Tour de France. So I use my telephone because it's easier to send the quotes to the guys in the office. And I noticed that if I use my telephone or if I have a microphone, obviously the mic attracts the riders more than the telephone, and the answers are not the same. I mean, you have the impression the riders are more focused if you have a bigger piece of equipment, you know, than if you just use a telephone. If you use a telephone, think, oh, this is a guy from the written press. I mean, he's not going to reproduce exactly what I said, and I mean, there's no they won't see my face or hear my voice in the paper. So actually, the reaction to the outlet is different from the writer's perspective. That's interesting to witness.
Yeah, I think there's a sort of more engagement. Sometimes the bigger the microphone that you have, you know, the more seriously they take you in a way. I think I'm not sure about the writers. Some of the writers certainly know about the podcast. I think people on the teams, a lot of the staff and, you know, communications people, they certainly know about the podcast, and we definitely get. There's more, you know, a press officer, for example, will go to a bit more trouble to make sure a writer does speak to us if we ask to speak to a certain writer. And I think because they understand now what it is we do, and that we do have an audience, as evidenced by all the questions we've got in this press conference.
The fastest closing in a world tour, the home of cycling with character. Ride and Watch with Rafa in 2019 as a partner EF Education First and Canyon Charam.
Hi, Cycling Podcast, Thomas WP here again. My question, is George Bennett invisible?
Thanks, Thomas. Is George Bennett invisible?
Well, he wasn't yesterday, was he? He was off the back. With laden down with bottles at one point.
Well, maybe invisible to his Jumbo-Visma team, because I read a tweet this morning from the team Jumbo-Visma manager saying how great the team had performed yesterday, and he mentioned it only Kruijswijk and Wout van Aert. So, do you become invisible when you're a New Zealander in a Dutch team? I don't know. It would be strange.
I suspect it's a sort of Alain Zubeldia type question, is it? Where you know he's been flying high overall without necessarily being seen, but I think he was fourth overall going into yesterday's stage, and he's obviously now fallen well away. I think that's a bit unfair with Bennett. I don't think he's an Alain Zubeldia rider at all.
No.
In fact, he's a guy who, even when he's been in the top 10 overall in the Giro or in the Tour de France a couple of years ago, I remember the finish at Périgueux, where Romain Bardet won a couple of years ago. It was George Bennett, despite sitting top 10 overall, who really, he really attacked initially. He didn't ride conservatively at all or cautiously. He attacked, and he was the guy that really set up the finale where Bardet attacked and won, and Froome cracked a little bit, lost some time. So he's not that sort of rider at all.
And he shouldn't be invisible, because we can tell you he's a media favorite. We all like to talk to George. He's a nice guy, very friendly, and always good quotes and things to say. So yeah, he shouldn't be.
Hi guys, this is Gerry Arthurs from Kilkenny in Ireland. I've been a friend of the pod since I was a little podling. My question relates to the final stage in Paris, the bunch sprint following a long, boring procession, which is routinely skipped by you guys, as it doesn't really produce too much exciting racing compared to the Greg LeMond and Laurent Fignon time trial. Having proposed to my wife on the Champs-Élysées on the last day of the tour in 1998, I'm just wondering, do you guys think that anything can be done to make that last stage more interesting? Again, having a time trial, but at least having some form of competitive element to it rather than the formulaic bunch sprint. And again, just to bring you guys, the Buffalo and Napalm and Monsieur BS, all the way to Paris before finishing the Tour de France. Thanks, guys.
Thanks, Gerry. Well, proposing to your wife is certainly one way to make it exciting, isn't it? The final stage of the Tour.
Bit of jeopardy there, isn't there? What if she said no? Well, we actually are going to Paris this year. The reason we've skipped in the last couple of years is purely logistics. I mean, last year it was almost impossible to have got from Biarritz up to Paris in time for the final stage, and you'd booked a holiday to kick off in San Sebastian, hadn't you, Rich? And I had to drive the car all the way home, so it was a logistical one. The year before, we finished in Marseille, so it made logical sense for Francois to go home from there rather than go all the way up to Paris and back. But this year, we are all going. I mean, 1989, even if they finish with a time trial, it's unlikely that that drama could be even close to being replicated, surely. Overturning a 50-second advantage in the final time trial. Greg LeMond beat Laurent Fignon overall by 8 seconds in the end, the closest ever tour. And I also think that the processional final stage, it gives the sprinters something to hang on through the rest of the race for, an incentive to struggle through the mountains. And let's face it, they're going to have a number of days where there's going to be nothing for them, really. And Paris, well, we always see people saying, oh, they should finish with a road stage in the Alps or just finish the tour on Mont Ventoux or something. But Francois, I mean, that's never going to happen, is it?
No, I mean, obviously, you mentioned logistic reasons for us to skip the Paris stages in the past, and there are logistic reasons as well for the tour organizers and for the teams and for everybody involved to have a procession stage on the last day, because otherwise, I mean, everything could be. I can tell you, because I was there in 1989 at the finale. It was a great sporting moment, but it was terrible for everyone involved, because all the television programs had their had already their, you know, features, magazines on Fignon, a Frenchman winning, and blah blah blah, and they had to redo everything. The jerseys were you know, it's like you have a reception with all the little canapes and everything to eat, and all of a sudden, you know, well, the bride says no. I mean, you know, it's in a way, I think everybody's happy with it, including the riders. And once again, and when I asked the question, why don't you do a time trial on the last day to Christian Prudhomme and other guys? Well, they all said, you know, like this year we finish in Val Thorens, probably the GC at that stage, except maybe for 8th or 9th place or 10th or 11th place, is kind of set. And then you would have an individual time trial on the last day, that doesn't mean anything. That's another kind of procession, but one by one, it would drag on forever. Sometimes individual time trials can be boring as such. And if there is nothing at stake at the end of it, and which will be the case 9 times out of 10, maybe it's better to have all the bunch together to go around the Champs-Élysées to have nice television pictures. This year, they'll be going through the Palais du Louvre. So they'll be, you know, I think for the promotion of Paris and tourism is probably much better this way.
Well, yeah, that's the whole point, isn't it? The Paris, finishing in Paris, gives some prestige to the Tour de France. I mean, ASO is based in Paris, for one thing. It's obviously the capital of France. It showcases the city and the landmarks. And on this thing of not racing, well, the sprinters are racing and their lead-out trains are racing. The overall riders, well, if you can't win the Tour de France in 20 days, you can't win it in 21, frankly. So, yeah, everyone knows that the race finishes on the Champs-Élysées, and it is a ceremony. It's a celebration of completing a lap of France.
It's also exciting to you know, from time to time, to see whether there won't be a bunch sprint. It's never happened. It doesn't happen very often, but, you know, Vinokourov tried to do that. Hinault won a bunch sprint. So, I mean, there's always a little question mark. Maybe this time we won't have a bunch sprint.
And Jerry should maybe come back with his wife to celebrate the 21st anniversary of his proposal.
Hi, Richard, Lionel and Francois. It's Dave, friend of the podcast from Staffordshire here. I was listening with interest to the discussions in week one regarding the speculation that Elie Viviani could move to Cofidis for the 2020 season, and in particular Lionel's surprise at this. With the career of a pro cyclist being so short in comparison to most professions, as well as the risk of injury and accidents bringing a premature end, is this not fully understandable? And I wonder as well that if the career length of a podcaster was the same as that of a professional cyclist, would Lionel not be tempted to pursue a big money opportunity, even if it involved working in the company of a certain Lance Armstrong? Keep up the good work, guys. Thank you.
Oh, Dave, what a suggestion. That Viviani to Cofidis, Bernie to the Armstrong podcast.
Wouldn't happen. I'm ruling myself out.
How much would it take for you to move to the Lance Armstrong podcast?
I think it's a moot point, because I'm not terribly sure that they'd be after me, would they? I mean, what?
I mean, I'm just asking. You know, what would be the ballpark figure, Lionel, for that?
Well, I'd need equity, obviously. You know, one of the great things about the cycling podcast is, you know, the sense that it's our thing that we've built up and hopefully continuing to build. Great working with you, Richard and Daniel, and having Francois as a guest. I mean, why on earth would I want to move? I mean, the only way I'd move is if.
Where is it recorded? Austin or Boulder, Colorado? Would you live there for 3 weeks?
Hang on, he hadn't quite finished that. The only way you'd move was if you were going to say something there.
No, I don't. I wouldn't move. No, we don't want you to move.
I mean, to the move.
The only way I'd move is if you were going to boot me out and make me an offer.
I don't have the power to boot you out. We're equal. We're equal partners in this, Lionel. So, no, come and get me, please, from Lionel Burney. And the other part of the question is Viviani.
Well, to be honest, I being only a guest in...
Francois, you're not available either.
The thing is, being a guest on the podcast and being only in it for the money, I would go, you know, if Lance invites me and gives me a lot of money, I might consider it.
But, what a mercenary, eh? Oh, dear.
Yeah, no way.
But Viviani, to cough with us, I mean, it's a funny one, isn't it? Because... he will almost certainly win fewer races. That's been the pattern of riders, especially sprinters, moving on from De Koenig Quickstep. I mean, Gaviria sort of bucked that trend a little bit last year. You know, he seemed to... Sorry, not last year. This is his first year, isn't it, at UAE Team Emirates? And he's won a few races and looked the same rider, but an awful lot of riders move on and they're pale imitations of... their former selves, because that is a team is a winning machine, isn't it? And you know, you look at Nicky Terpstra at Total Direct Energy. I mean, he's a strong rider, but he's not going to have the opportunities that he had at De Koenig Quickstep. So Viviani will go to Cofidis, earn a lot of money for a couple of years, perhaps also have the opportunity to go to the Olympic Games and defend his Omnium title, which may be a factor too. But yeah, I don't think any of us would blame a rider for taking a big contract.
Yeah, I mean, from the point of view of Cofidis, it's an interesting move, because they've always had, this past couple of years, you know, struggling to be in contention for GC places or big races. They relied on sprinters. I mean, they had Buhani who won races, you know, even if he's been kind of kicked out of the team. Let's face it, that's what happened. So there is a tradition of sprinting the team. They have a train, like Christophe Laporte became a lead-out man. They used to have Geoffrey Soup, who was a very good lead-out man as well. So the kind of culture of sprinting the team is there. And if Elia Vivani doesn't win stages in big tours with Cofidis, but Cofidis will be World Tour next season, he might change things. But the thing is, he might be entered in smaller races in France and win them easily. And apps, you know, UCI points, the money, everything a team like Cofidis needs.
What next for Buhani?
Oh, well, that's a very good question. I have no idea. I mean, it's kind of, probably for the wrong reasons, it's been kind of, you know, the black sheep of French cycling. He's a temperamental man, but sometimes it can be, well, you know, sprinters have to be you know, strong, tempered. I don't know. I haven't heard anything about Buhani. It's an odd one, but obviously if Viviani is coming, I mean, we know he won't be with Cofidis next season, and I really don't know where he's going.
Hi, this is Jenny, a friend of the podcast in Glasgow. I've got a question for the press conference. I'd hoped it might be something incisive about cycling, but actually I want to know about Francois' porte-bonheur du Tour, which has been making such an appearance on social media.
Ah, well, that's a nice one. Well, actually... last year, if you remember, I used to eat flan at every stage and put pictures of flan, you know, in every kind of situation and in the race. But for health reasons, I've been advised that I should, you know, refrain from eating flan. So I decided to change because I can't, you know, take pictures of flan anymore. Or I could take pictures of flan but not eat them, which is which would be a little bit silly. So I actually took a little blue mascot that's been given to me by a dear friend, and I'm carrying it around France and making pictures of it, like a little, my own little series of, you know, hopefully you know, it's nice to see that you're asking the question and you're, well, hopefully looking
following
for
its progress. We almost yeah. drove off with it on the bonnet yesterday.
Yeah,
that's right.
You forgot it. You forgot your mascot on Thibault. You forgot your mascot Thibault on the bonnet yesterday.
Well, it's actually I found out it's actually a little Japanese cartoon character called Doraemon. So I called him Doraemon Polydor. So.
Well, you can check out François Thomaso on social media. Are you posting them on Instagram or
yeah, I put them on Instagram and yeah, you know, automatically goes on Facebook and Twitter.
And
yeah.
So are you Sauveur Merlin on Instagram as well as on Twitter?
No, on Instagram and François Thomaso, very simple. Yeah.
There we are. So if you want to see the adventures of
Doraemon Polydor,
then follow François on Instagram.
Hello, chaps. Matt Sully here from Gold Coast, Australia. Always love listening to the podcast, highlight of the week when it comes out. Just listened to the press conference that you did for the Tour de France and got me thinking, because I've often had conversations with friends and put a few comments on different YouTube channels about the GOAT of Eddy Merckx. Now, the reality is he was caught for doping. I think he was expelled from the Giro, yet we still call him the GOAT. Well, if I'm not mistaken, there's a certain Lance Armstrong who was caught for doping, had all his Tour de France victories taken away from him. How come he's not the GOAT? And I would love for you guys to have a chat about why the cycling community turns a blind eye to Eddie the GOAT and his drug-taking offences. Over and out, Matt Sully on the Gold Coast.
Thanks for your question, Matt. Well, I mean, this is a question that gets asked a lot. And I think I've been thinking again about Armstrong the last couple of days, listening to your conversation, Lionel, with David Walsh about the 1999 tour. And it's quite amazing to be reminded of just how, just the front of Armstrong in being challenged pretty rigorously and pretty consistently at that 99 tour, even, you know, just the first of the seven tour victories, being confronted with, oh, there's a bike ride going through. It looks like an organized bike ride with a motorcycle escort through very heavy traffic. Don't envy them that. But yeah, I mean, there was Armstrong in 99 at the start of his seven-year run, being confronted with, you know, hard evidence, the cortisone positive, you know, the fact that Fissine had been the year before, that Christophe Basson was alleging things in the press and so on. And that was what made, that's what puts Armstrong in a slightly different category, I think. But also, you know, at a different point in history. And I think the context of the Festina tour is really important to understanding the nature of Armstrong's doping and cheating. And I think Eddy Merckx competed in a different era where there was, for better or worse, a very different attitude towards doping. And very different products available as well.
And it's illegal. To me, I've said it a million times, I'd say it a billion times if it needed. Doping is a legal issue. It's not a moral or an health issue. In Merckx's time, in 1989, covered the tour, Guido Bontempi was caught for steroids. You know what happened? He was kicked back at the bottom of the GC, got a fine of 100 Swiss francs, and started the next day. So the rules were different. Let's imagine a situation in a country where you know, murder is, you know, capital punishment doesn't exist, and then it exists. You know, the guys who committed an offense 20 years before were submitted to the laws of the time, and it would change. So I mean, in Merckx's time, even if you were caught for doping, you were usually, you had a fine, you might have been you know, expelled from the Giro. That happened to Merckx in 1969, and that's it. So you can't compare periods, because once again, doping was less of an offense at the time. You can say it's a pity, but you can't rewrite history. That's what it was, you know. At the time, doping was tolerated in many ways. It was not seen as an offense, and by the fans, the fans didn't care at all. If you start blaming Merckx for the same thing that you blame Armstrong for, then Fausto Coppi was on dope as well, and probably all the tour winners of pre-war. Maurice Garin was probably taking stuff, but you know, it's another. I mean, can you compare the medieval times with our values today? You can't. And in cycling, it's exactly the same, unfortunately.
But the law changed after Festina, didn't it?
It did, yeah.
And it was, well, by 99, it was illegal to take all of these substances. And I mean, EPO, there wasn't actually a ratified test for it until the Sydney Olympics in 2000. So maybe legally and morally, there was a loophole there, a grey area, in that it was not possible to detect whether Armstrong had been taking EPO then. But once that EPO test came in and was ratified, and everyone knew, there was no ambiguity at all in 99.
Festina ended that. I think it was the wake up call that, as David Walsh says in the podcast that he did with him, Lionel, it was a wake up call for journalists, for riders, and after 98, there could be no ambiguity anymore. Where there was ambiguity before, you know, and I wrote a book about the 1988 Olympic 100 meter final where Ben Johnson tested positive. And when you look at the attitudes around drugs at the time, they were completely different. I think as well about, you know, football, you know, people don't like football analogies all the time, but when you watch matches from the 70s and you see tackling from behind, really, really skillful players were just hacked to the ground routinely. And you can condemn that, but it was allowed, it was tolerated at the time. And so you can't really condemn footballers who use those sorts of tactics because they were permitted.
Yeah, but I do also have sympathy with Matt's point about referring to Eddie Merckx as the greatest of all time. His legacy is intact and admired by many, and yet, you know, the positive tests are on the record. It's not like they don't exist, and it's not like they are airbrushed from history. They are a matter of fact and a matter of record. So, I can kind of see the point, but again, it may seem kind of inconsistent, perhaps even hypocritical. But you know, the weight of Armstrong's doping in the context of the time was so significant.
Yeah, I mean, I'd agree with the fact that Armstrong was a scapegoat, like Virenque was a scapegoat in the Festina scandal. They were the guys who kind of crystallized doping, whereas in Armstrong's case, all the riders of the time ended up confessing as well. But he was the number one. He was the guy taking the money. The problem with Armstrong is not the doping. It's the fact that he took the money and money that was not due. Is not to me. I've never considered Armstrong as a bad athlete or really as a doper. The thing he did is more a crook. You know, he took money away from guys who deserved that money more than him. That's the point.
He was a doper, though.
He was, yeah, sure. But that's
he was a big old doper.
But morally, the thing you can really blame him for. What if everybody takes doping and, you know, in the end it's a fair race and everybody shared the money and anything? But in the case of Armstrong, he made millions of dollars by cheating, and so some guys were cheated, and that's the point.
Let's not cast Armstrong in too sympathetic a light, because Lionel might be tempted to go off and join this podcast.
Hi, my name is Peter. I'm from East Yorkshire. I'm a friend of the podcast this year, thanks to a wonderful Christmas gift from my wonderful wife. The tour's been fantastic. Well done for some brilliant coverage so far, and I'm really looking forward to the next 2 weeks. So the question that I've got for the press conference is really related to the team time trial. I can't understand how so many teams didn't bring their A game with them when they've got GC ambition. So they've got lots of climbers to support their GC contender, yet they didn't have the right kind of team to limit their losses against some of the strongest team time trials. So when I look down at the list, you've got UAE, Movistar, Trek, and AG2R, all with GC ambitions, and they've lost a minute to a minute 19 seconds before they've even got to the foot of a climb. Surely that can't be right, and just would like your view on that. Anyway, thank you very much, and looking forward to hearing more of what you've got to say.
Well, thanks for the question, Peter, and thanks to your wife as well for her fantastic gift. That's a great idea, isn't it? Gift of friendship to the cycling podcast. Anyway, to the question, I think it was a difficult balance to strike in this tour when the mountains are going to be so significant, and it's probably too early to answer the question properly. We'll know at the end of the race whether they got it right or not. Mitchelton and Scott, for example, have always been very strong in team time trials and perhaps not quite as strong this time. And Matt White explained that it was because the balance of the team was a little bit different this year. There's slightly more emphasis on climbers over the big ruler types. So, you know, that was getting the formula right is difficult. Ineos, of course, second in the team time trial, very strong in the crosswind stage. And yet, Bernal and Thomas, they were quite isolated on La Planche des Belles Filles. While Poles was dropped quite early, Michał Kwiatkowski was the last guy. Might they struggle a bit in the high mountains? Who knows? We're going to find that out. And I guess we'll know at the end of the tour whether teams lost anything significant through the team time trial or not.
Yeah, I guess also skimming the teams down from 9 to 8 may force, you know, forces teams to make strategic decisions. I said after the night on the team time trial, and I was criticized for that in my opinion, it was a bit irrelevant in terms of the GC, didn't make such huge differences. I think the following days confirmed that. Movistar had a bad time trial. Look where they are now. They actually were the best team yesterday. Quintana is in a great position, so it didn't affect them at all. And the mountains would probably, make them show exactly what they're worth. Look at Trek Segafredo, lost time, but they held the yellow jersey only 4 days later, so it obviously didn't affect them too much either. So once again, I don't think, especially team time trial on day two, I don't think it has a major impact on the GC in the end.
The cycling podcast at the 2019 Tour de France is supported by Science in Sport. Science in Sport, fueled by science.
Hi, it's Pete Reynolds here from Castlemaine in Australia, a long-time listener and friend of the podcast. I've got two questions that relate to the route design of the Tour de France. I understand that the start and finish towns pay ASO for the privilege of hosting, but is there any kind of discount for regular repeat venues? You know, for example, La Planche des Belles Filles has hosted the stage finish 4 times in the last 8 years. Have they paid less? Also, with some of the really iconic venues like Alpe d'Huez, that arguably the Tour needs more than they need the Tour, do these venues pay an even smaller amount to ASO? And my second question is that, have ASO ever considered rerunning an exact replica route from the past? E.g. Merckx's, 1969 Route 21, or indeed a section of the Tour from a year, like the first week, for example. Love the podcast. Keep up the good work. Bye.
Well, Francois and I are actually talking about the idea of repeating a tour from the past. I suggested 1903, but I think the average length of the stage was about 360 kilometres, so can't see that happening. But I've always thought that the 1989 course is probably the classic, modern classic. It was the first of the sort of shorter tours, wasn't it? They trimmed about 1,000 kilometres off the total distance.
Yeah, well, replicating the 1903 tour would need taking into account some very often overlooked fact is that they had a rest day between each stage.
Lovely.
So, yeah.
Wonderful.
So why not? I mean, but it would make for a longer tour, probably. Secondly, they try to emulate by bits. Like, remember, 2010, they to celebrate the Tourmalet, they had this stage in the Pyrenees, a big emphasis on that. In 2011, the Galibier to celebrate that. In the 2003 tour, they didn't replicate the 1903 tour, but most of the stages were in towns that were part of the course in 1903. So by bits, that's what they're trying to do. Some tours, sometimes we should look at it more closely. But some tours sometimes ring bells. Like I've been writing the what's called the tourist guide of the Tour de France, meaning I write little stuff on each town hosting a tour, start and finish, and I write about the towns and the villages that the race passes through. And this year, for instance, I found by just looking in the files on my computer that many of the villages and towns we're going through, we'd been there in the past. So that there is sometimes, like I think that the stage to Chalon-sur-Saône we had this year, which was the most boring one, by the way, exactly the same stage existed in the past. So that there is some by bits, replications of past tours.
Maybe repeat the 92 tour of the European Economic Community to celebrate Brexit.
The 1903 tour, there are six stages covering 2,400 kilometres. But it ran from July the 1st to July the 19th. Way more rest days than race days. I mean, this sounds like my...
It went on until the war, actually. We tend to forget that.
The first tour lasted until the war.
No, the fact that you had rest days after every stage. Quick one about everybody talks about Albert Londres and when he interviewed the Pélissier brothers and the doping thing and that. But on the rest days, Albert Londres, who was covering the tour, was going to the mental institutions in the town on the rest day to write another book on mental institutions. So, well,
this is 1924.
Yeah, 1924. If we replicated that, we could probably do two. Two jobs
in the same podcast.
Yeah, two different podcasts.
Very, very quickly on the issue of the paying for the start and finish towns. Do you know if there's a discount? Does Poe get a discount?
It's a very, very secret deals. Nobody exactly knows the revenue of ASO. They publish their accounts, but some of them are not public, like their profits, for instance. I mean, they're not, at the French bourse. So there's very few ways to know exactly where the money comes from, what kind of money they're making. So normally, there is a grid of fees the towns are paying. You pay more for a finish than you pay for a start. Probably have a discount because they have it every year. So that there's a kind of an agreement with the tour. They managed to, they made a theme park on the tour in town. So Poe kind of helps the promotion of the tour. As for L'Alpe d'Huez, you were saying the tour needs L'Alpe d'Huez more than L'Alpe d'Huez needs the tour. If the tour didn't go to L'Alpe d'Huez for 20 years, I'm sure you the impact on the summer tourism in L'Alpe d'Huez would be tragic.
Hi guys, it's Carl here from Belfast, Northern Ireland. I'm still waiting on my Friends of the Podcast shout out. However, I know it must be only a few episodes away now. My question for you guys is, this is only my second time watching the tour in its entirety, and I thought stage six, and in particular the last kilometer, delivered some of the most thrilling and heart in your mouth racing that I've seen. However, I did note that a lot of the riders remarked before the stage that the extra kilometre was a bit unnecessary. What's your opinion on adding ridiculously difficult sections to already difficult stages? And in your opinion, which stage characteristics lend themselves best to the best racing? Thanks.
Well, Carl, thanks very much for your question. And first things first, thank you very much for being a friend of the podcast. Maybe all three of us should thank you just to make up for the fact that you've not had a shout-out yet.
Thanks very much, Carl.
Merci beaucoup, Carl.
As to your question, I agree. I thought the new finish at La Planche des Belles Filles, it was a thrilling finish, and it did deliver. I mentioned, I think, on the podcast, it was a bit like, it was it's become such a familiar finish, the old finish, that the extra bit was almost like going through the back of the cupboard into Narnia. It was like a hidden world, and we didn't really know what to expect. And the fact that the road was unpaved made it all the more kind of otherworldly and exciting, really. And it's funny because we were talking a bit earlier about the first ever Tour de France, and the kind of the epic nature of that, the distances and the poor quality of the roads and such. And it feels like bike racing is going back in time, trying to recreate some elements of that, not with the distances so much, but with the you know, the gravel roads and really reconnecting, I think, the sport to the countryside in a way, and to a kind of, I don't know, taking it away from, I mean, I think this ties into a lot of fashions in cycling, some of which you've explored in your Explore series, Lionel. There is a vogue for going off-road, and partly that's because of all the cars and the danger on the roads, but I like it, and I think we've seen at the Vuelta as well that it does often deliver great excitement.
The whole point of the event is that it's entertainment, isn't it? And it's about storytelling and creating talking points, and we were all talking about whether the final kilometre or so would have an impact on the race, and then afterwards we were talking about the impact it did have on the race. It looked dramatic, spectacular, and I think that all of the Grand Tour organisers are trying to kind of seek new ground in order to ensure that there's this sense of anticipation, excitement, uncertainty. If the riders know exactly what's in front of them, then the racing can become a bit stale. We've seen with the Mur de Huy in Flèche Wallonne over years and years now that really we know exactly the script before they set off from the start. And so it's up to the race organisers to innovate. And I think there is a point where it becomes almost you know, a circus act, but I don't think the Tour de France has got anywhere close to that. I mean, the finish at La Planche des Belles Filles was dramatic and exciting, and it was in no way beyond what the riders should be expected to tackle. I thought it was great.
I mean, the Tour, compared to other Grand Tours, has been rather conservative, and it's normal, because when you're by far the leader of your industry, you tend to be conservative and stick to your tradition. And the riders, when they talk about the Tour, are conservative as well. Remember, every time there's a cobble stage, there'll be controversy. Oh, there shouldn't be a cobble stage on the Tour, and blah, blah, blah. The thing is, my impression is that there's been so much effort by the Giro and the Vuelta to innovate, to try to get away from the shadow that are cast upon them by the Tour, that they've been trying. Remember, there was a team time trial on sand on the Vuelta a couple of years back. So they've been trying everything to try and distinguish themselves from the Tour. And the Tour is the only reacting by little bits, by putting some of those gravelly stages in the thing to say, look, we're following you guys. We're ready to innovate, but we're still we're still leading the way, and so we're going to do it, but we're going to do it gradually, and we're not going to, as you say, turn into a circus when at times you had the impression that the Giro, with the number, with the sometimes the elevation in certain stages of the Giro, looked like, you know, this is in the face of Christian Prudhomme, you know, look at what we can do, and in a way, by not innovating, the Tour tends from time to time to say, we don't need to innovate, we are the Tour.
That team time trial at the Vuelta in Puerto Banús, I think, mm-hmm. it was, where they went onto the wooden causeway, yeah. that goes across the beach. I mean, that was a joke. They may as well have had a pedalo race out in the sea.
I would like that.
I've actually got a question for you three, Lionel, Richard and Francois. Did any one of you leave a toothbrush and a pair of underwear at my house? Because if you did, I'm very sorry, but my dog Ruby has had a go at it and it's gone, so she ate it. So yeah, if you're missing it, I'm very sorry, but never leave anything at my house again, please. Thank you.
Gosh, well, this is embarrassing, isn't it, Lionel? Did you leave your pants at Charlotte's house?
I've been wearing the same pants since Brussels, just alternating inside out, outside in.
We should explain that we stayed at Charlotte's house in Brussels. Charlotte's a friend, and she put us up there.
That could, yeah, absolutely, well cleared up. No, I didn't leave any pants behind.
Francois had to dash off, so we can only assume they're his. No.
Are they blue and white horizontal striped pants?
I think this is a wind-up from Charlotte.
Is there room for a string of onions in the front?
Well, Charlotte's been leaving me voice messages every day there's been a Belgian winner, so she's left me a few of those, but this one was a bit different. Thanks for the question, Charlotte. Nice try. Maybe send a proper question in next week. Well, listen, fellas, we've got a busy rest day. If that's not an oxymoron. Well, a couple of us have a busy rest day, don't we?
And a couple of us are oxymorons.
Yeah. Lionel, you've got a lunchtime engagement.
I have.
As per.
Yeah.
I've got some interviews to do. I've just got some information through about when they're happening. That's good.
And I have your washing up to look after, you know. So
yeah. So we better crack on. Thanks very much for all your questions. Apologies if we didn't get to your question. We did get a lot, and we will be doing this again on the next rest day. So please, if we didn't answer your question this time, don't be deterred from sending in another question, and we'll get around to it next week. Some of the questions were quite similar, so we just had to be selective in the ones that we picked. But thank you very much for sending them in. And our daily coverage resumes tomorrow with Stage 11. And we've still got a very exciting race in store, I think. Any more business before we go from this press conference episode, chaps?
Just a reminder, Kilometre Zero, every weekday morning. Today's episode, Richard was on the press officers who we work with on a daily basis here at the Tour, and you'll hear how the Tour works from their point of view.
You will indeed. And lots more Kilometre Zeros to come. We're also recording a sort of road trip episode, which we did a couple of years ago. That will be available for friends of the podcast after the Tour. So we're recording bits and pieces every day, and that went down quite well a couple of years ago. So we thought we'd do it again this year, and there'll be a friends special episode as well from your lunch today, Lionel.
Yes, indeed. Yes, well. Yes.
Sign up as a friend of the podcast at thecyclingpodcast.com, and you might get a shout out at the end of one of the episodes as well. But that's all for now. Thank you very much, Francois.
Thank you.
Thank you, Lionel.
Thank you, Richard.
Marriott Bonvoy is the official hotel partner of US Soccer. Join Marriott Bonvoy today to get closer to the game with exclusive perks, unforgettable experiences, and benefits that go beyond the pitch. Spring Hill Suites, part of Marriott Bonvoy, offers complimentary hot breakfast and spacious all-suite accommodations, perfect for the whole team, with room for up to 6 guests. Make your next getaway a win. Learn more at springhillsuites.marriott.com.